Hey there, Spoiler Show fans. Just Matt Bowes here this week as Marcus Cunningham was occupied and couldn't make it. Today I'm joined by Devin Bruce of the excellent local podcast, Scotch and Comics. How's it going?
I'm doing well. I have a scotch in my hand, thanks to you.
So. You're next to some comics as well, so you're kind of in your, you know, in your home court.
That's right.
It's not too bad.
Yeah. It's my home away from home.
Yeah. So, explain for our listeners who may not have heard your show, but what's the gimmick?
The gimmick for my podcast.
Yeah.
It was something I already did, and I didn't have a podcast, and I felt I needed a kind of an outlet, and I was kind of wanted to have one, so when I was thinking, what would I do, why don't I just record something I already do, which is drink scotch and read comic books, and then instead of thinking, oh, I should write reviews of these, and then never actually doing that, just putting a microphone near me and talking into the microphone, so...
Yeah.
That's like I get an evening and a stack of comics and a bottle of whiskey and I just go until I'm done. And
yeah.
Then the arduous process of editing follows.
It's a lot of fun. I like to hear like the different kinds of things you're drinking. You make mixed drinks sometimes, like you're doing hot toddies in the last episode I was listening to. Like you're quite knowledgeable about both the scotch and the comics. So it is like, you know, a learning experience.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Like I like to pretend that I know what I'm doing.
Look at me. But the Spoiler Show kind of came out of a similar impulse as well because, you know, it was myself and Marcus. We like to talk about things. We have a wide ranging of interests. We like to talk to interesting people. We, you know, we have a lot of friends too. So just bring them into the conversation. We started a book club as well. So once a month we're doing an episode that way. And yeah, it's a great way to meet people, learn new things, and just shoot the shit. Just, you know, something I enjoy doing anyway.
Yeah, It's social media,
yeah.
Whether it's a podcast or Twitter or whatever, right?
Like, yeah.
And I'm always of the kind of person who I think I probably do it more, less in execution and more in thought. But the whole point isn't just to be like, I'm doing this right now. It should be, I'm doing this right now. It's cool. Why aren't you doing it with me? Would you like to talk to me about it? So on and so forth.
Yeah. That's one thing I like about your podcast. It's not like patrician stentorian, just sort of like, intoning that you know a lot of stuff and people should listen to you. It's more like, I'm a personable guy. You probably would enjoy spending time with me in real life. It's that sort of, you know, fireside chat thing of just trying to, you know, ingratiate yourself in their life. Like, yeah, you probably just like having me around.
Well, thank you.
And I like to think we do the same. I know for sure we don't a lot of the time because... Yeah, not every episode's a winner for us. So,
well, hey, I don't do very many of them, so your quality output's probably quantifiably more than mine.
That's sweet. Sweet of you to say.
Oh.
So we were talking, you know, just a little bit earlier before we started recording about Star Trek. And something that I've just been thinking about for the past, like, 3 weeks or so, I just can't get out of my head. I've talked to Brendan Brown about it, who you probably hear on a later podcast closer to April for Secret Project. Oh, yeah. Press that down there. But the idea of culture and Star Trek, I mean, Roddenberry's vision is that of just ultimate peaceful Earth. Everyone is working together for, you know, no one's at cross purposes. Everyone going together for one goal. It's kind of a communist state, essentially, when you think about it. Post-scarcity, really.
Yep.
But what does this mean for the state of culture and the arts in the Star Trek world? Devin's actually pouring me a coffee right now. So, and if you're hearing it, we're enjoying many fine beverages at the same time. But like, what do you think about that? Because it seems like everyone's cultural intake in the Star Trek universe is kind of quits around 1952. I mean, they don't seem to go much farther than that. And the problem with it is, I feel it's almost lazy writing.
Mm.
Like, it's what? 24th, 25th century is when Star Trek takes place, right? And it's just, you know, they've got the star date at that time, so it's a little oblique to figure out when. But, like, there has to have been some book that someone in the 22nd century wrote that everyone liked.
Right. Well, and I think you could interpret it as lazy. I think there's a lot of possible explanation for it. I think part of it would be that you've got... you want to make it seem comfortable and reassuring,
yeah,
and easy to relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, at least when they're putting it out in the late 60s, early 70s,
mm-hmm,
if you go back only a little bit
Yeah.
But not so recent that it's not, like, tongue-in-cheek,
yeah.
look at me, wink, wink.
Yeah.
Then it can be familiar, and I think so there might be a little bit of carryover from that.
Okay.
Even in, like, if Star Trek made a reference to something that happened in the 80s,
yeah.
when it was coming out in the 80s, I think the audience would be like, nah, I'm not going to accept that.
Well, yeah, but, like, my problem is that, like, the Star Trek audience is the Star Trek audience.
Now, but when TNG started,
yeah.
it wasn't.
Yeah, that would have been a risk. But nowadays, like, I feel like the audience is so ingrained, and they'll basically follow them anywhere. I mean, Enterprise, right?
Yeah,
am
yeah.
I right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you can do that, but the cultural references are all kind of, I hate to say, but, like, it feels almost like they're reaching up. Like, see, on our show, we only refer to, you know, fine jazz. We refer to Shakespeare. We refer to the detective fiction of the 30s, 40s. We don't stoop to pop culture.
But the detective, at the time, each of those things were the pop culture.
Very true.
And they lasted. So yeah. I think that might be them being able to say, well, it lasted. It yeah. will still last.
But the thing that bothered me is that nothing since then
yeah.
appears to have lasted. And I mean, they have 3D chess. They figured that one out. Mm-hmm. That's kind of cool.
Baseball was still happening in the 22nd century, according to Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, wasn't there... No, that was Back to the Future that the Cubs won the World Series
yeah, yeah.
in 2010 or something. And
yeah.
it didn't come true.
Somewhere in Deep Space Nine, there are overt references where a player from that team has existed.
Yeah.
And they came in, I think they thought it was through the holodeck, but then it was like an alien
yeah.
who was pulling something out of Benjamin Sisko's mind.
Yeah.
But that happened post
yeah.
the airing of the show.
Wasn't there was a team called the London Kings that apparently wins the World Series?
Yeah. Like, so at least baseball
yeah.
survives.
They've got baseball, yeah.
But, like, and baseball is a game that doesn't really change. You might have minor
yeah.
things. You might have minor, what am I trying to say? Minor changes in
adjustments
in the rules,
yeah.
but baseball's still baseball.
Yeah, there's only so much that's going to change.
If you're going to reference either, like, a new genre, you have to invent that genre.
True.
And
but think about Battlestar Galactica. I mean, they had their, what, Colors, which was their card game.
Mm-hmm.
They had Pyramid, which was their, like, rugby, basketball,
yeah, but Pyramid, you could put Pyramid to the checkers, or, like, the chess.
Exactly, but, like, they didn't actually have to think of that much new shit, really. It was just
yeah.
sort of like, yeah, we have a card game, it looks like this, you don't need to explain the rules.
Yeah,
we have this.
It's more organic in Battlestar than it is,
yeah.
but I think for, first of all, for Star Trek, all the futuristic stuff was there so that Roddenberry could do his morality plays that he wanted to do.
Yeah,
so
wagon train in space,
yeah,
as they call it.
It doesn't matter
yeah.
what happened between now and the future.
Also,
the
there's future the eugenics wars. Think about it. So,
yeah, that was another thing I was
yeah.
going to say. There's probably a lot of fighting,
yeah.
and a lot of great art does come from that, but
yeah.
if you're... I don't know enough about, you know, what happens in the gap.
Yeah.
But if you're on the verge of extinction, your art may not survive.
True. There's probably not a lot of paintings of Khan left over from the eugenics wars. Perhaps the, you know, once the, you know, clone wars or whatever, they were super soldier people, essentially. Once that conflict was taken care of, maybe they struck it from the record.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would just like it if the Federation kind of... I don't know, like, I was thinking about the planet Ryza, which... That's the beach planet where they go...
Oh, Rigel.
No, Ryza.
Ryza?
Ryza.
Okay, what's Rigel 4 then?
Rigel 4...
Isn't that where they always went to have...
That was in the Star Trek Classic.
Okay.
TNG on, Ryza is the pleasure planet where...
Okay, okay.
I think it's where that Captain's Holiday episode was
yeah.
in TNG, and
okay.
it's where you see Dax in a bikini on DS9. That's why I remember it so
well.
Hold on.
Just going to take a moment to enjoy that.
Yeah, dots went all the way down.
Yeah.
yeah.
All right, good.
But, like, that should be the Ibiza of space. It should be, like, new, you know, hyper polka or some weird form of music that
yeah.
they've got now. We should be hearing new jams from Ryza.
But if you're going to go use the reference for Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
What's the big cultural touch point that they used in Battlestar Galactica? all along the Watchtower. They didn't write a new song.
That's true.
They used something that the viewers would understand.
Just a remix of it. And, I don't know. It's just strange. And I was talking to Brendan Brown about this, and he says, you know, it's a monoculture post-scarcity. Like, the reasons why great art exists, you know, conflict, wanting to get laid, all these things, they're kind of not an issue anymore.
Yeah.
There's conflict against, you know, the Cardassians. There's conflict against Klingons. But there isn't really interpersonal conflict. So, yeah. And, yeah, it's just difficult for me to wrap my head around the more I think about it.
I was reading a book, and if I could remember what it was, I would drop the name of the book. But mm-hmm. it might have been Sex at Dawn, mm-hmm. which is a reimagining of human culture and human prehistory, anthropological culture and sexual culture. And sure. I think that was where it was from. And it said that you needed to have civilization to have art, or like what we think of as civilization to have art. Essentially, because if everything's good, you don't need art, because everything's good. You're sitting around and you nap for 6 hours a day and you eat beans and you have this great varied sexual experimentation in your tribe, and that's all you do. But when you are ground under the heel of your serf master,
you need something
else. You need to get that out of it.
When you're working in an agrarian society, and it might also have to do with free time as well, because if you're a hunter-gatherer, I mean, you're just eating food and then you have to move on.
Yeah.
But if you're an agrarian society, you know, guns, germs, and steel would dictate that in addition to getting all the best germs from your animals and things, you're also having time to think about not where your next meal is coming from.
Yeah.
I mean, you are able to think about that. So maybe the post-scarcity environment has just gone completely the other way. And, you know, you can have anything you'd ever want at your fingertips. You just starve for, you know, you just, it's crazy. Like,
and that's why you go back to your jazz and your 20th century crime fiction and your agrarian pastoral baseball.
Yeah. Oh, that was one of my favorite episodes of Deep Space Nine, is when they play baseball against the Vulcans. And that was just such a great summation of Benjamin Sisko's character.
Yeah.
Just never gives up, loves baseball.
Yeah.
Tries to teach other people, because no one else understands what baseball is either. Like, all of these pastimes are so insular. I know that we don't really... Oh, you do. In the first Dixon Hill episode on TNG, he invites Data, Crusher, and Geordi, I think, to come on into the holodeck and experience the Dixon Hill detective game with him. And they, you know, they kind of take to it. Data makes like a funny gangster voice, and Crusher starts using some slang, but it's not something they know about.
Yeah.
Which, to be fair, would have been 400 years in the past. So
it's interesting that Picard still knows Shakespeare and Sherlock Holmes, though.
Yeah, sure. He's a Renaissance man.
And we can both go on the record and say that Deep Space Nine is the best of the Star Trek series?
Okay, good. Yeah. Good. That is not even in question.
Okay, we can continue to discuss.
Yeah, Deep Space Nine, it did so many great things. I mean, that's the only really work of fiction that I could think of that comes up in the Star Trek universe is, I think it was Vulcan Love Slave is the book that Quark is hawking. But this came up at a discussion on Saturday, in case any of the people there are listening. It wasn't just me. but yeah, like, I guess the idea of the holosuites as well, that's, yeah. But it delved into actual psychology of people,
mm-hmm.
whereas Star Trek, it's usually just having fun and, you know, having a science adventure, you know.
Yeah.
Doesn't really need to.
It had an ongoing storyline because you had a number of recurring characters that you could have recurring characters because no one, like, everyone was stuck in one place.
Yep.
So people would come to you and you had to deal with them and the after effects of what happened after they arrived, as opposed to, well, we're causing a bunch of after effects and see you later.
Yeah.
Like, they were able to do, like, almost season length stories and weave all that through, where you can't really do that, or they didn't do that in Next Generation, and they didn't really do that to the same degree in Voyager.
They had the species 8472 against the Borg thing, and mm-hmm. This just doesn't work that well because you also need to figure in your monster of the week or whatever.
Yeah,
so it is quite challenging. But yeah, the something like the Bajoran, you know, the occupation, then the prophet, then the religious war that kind of ensues, and then Gul Dukat, like all that stuff.
Oh, and the tailor. I never remember the tailor's name.
Garrick.
Garrick, yeah. Like
he's an amazing character. He's one of my favorites.
There's so many good things about what they're able to do. And that's the other thing. I honestly think that the best ensemble of characters is in that. As much as I like Riker and Geordi and Data, and as much as I like Spock and Scotty and Bones, I think the possibilities that you have with, you know, not everyone's getting along. You have the Federation and you have the Bajorans, and then you also have Odo, who he's kind of his own little thing, and O'Brien... he's a callback to the previous series, but he ends up becoming his own character. Like, they're all such interesting characters, and mostly, I can't think of a bad actor. Like, people talk
Jake
crap
Sisko
about
early, but early, he gets better.
He was 13.
He gets better.
Yeah. And Quark, I could ramble on and on.
Yeah. The idea of the space station as well, it's like...
Yeah.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of post-war Berlin, post-war Vienna, all those cities that are portioned off into, you know, here's the American district, here's the Russian district, here's the French district. Like, there's so much just potential for drama just from this setting, and it just works so well. So, check it out. Deep Space Nine, if you haven't heard of it, you probably aren't listening to my podcast. So, it's great stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, getting back to your sort of métier, your podcast, what have you been reading for comics lately?
What have I been reading for comics? My book club, I think I mentioned off air, but my book club just finished the first 35 plus the 0.5 issues of The Unwritten, which is great.
It's pretty good, yeah.
It's when I'm reading it, I've read other things that are similar to it, like the Thursday Next novels. Like, where, you know, narrative is its own thing and it affects people and people affect it and so on and so forth. So there's parallels to it, but it's clearly not the same.
Yeah.
Actually, a friend of mine in book club said that he found a lot of really interesting comparisons between The Unwritten and Fringe. And at first I was like, you are crazy. And then he said, think about it. Brilliant, mysterious man has some kind of hidden agenda.
Yeah.
There's a secret organization. He's taken a girl and kidnapped her and turned her into a weapon for his own ends.
True.
Estranged father and son relationship. I was just like, whoa, that is a lot of superficial similarities there, actually.
And if you want to talk about another great storytelling engine, I mean... The idea that all fiction exists and kind of is its own thing and you can travel into that world, that's pretty amazing.
And
throw in Harry Potter, too.
Great. Yeah, throw in Harry Potter, throw in, you know, the A.A. Milne, Christopher Milne relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
Throw in all that other stuff. Like, the nice thing about it is it could be fiction. It could be fiction prose literature.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's stories.
Yeah.
So, like, Dino the dinosaur from the Flintstones is in one of the panels when they're doing the funny animal stories.
It's almost like something like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but not falling off the rails like I found Century to do.
Oh, I haven't finished Century yet.
It kind of just goes to a really, really weird place. Yeah. I don't know if you would have gotten to it if you're only on issue 36, but the part with the Tinker...
Yeah, the Tinker is in the 30s.
I really like that stuff. That was one of my favorites. And I also really liked the Leviathan arc, which I think is...
Before that,
yeah. That was really good, too. That was one that I feel bad that I don't read anymore, because I was reading it at work, and I don't...
Yeah, yeah.
But if I wanted to, I'd have to buy the whole thing, and then my house is full of books. It's just...
Yeah. It's really great. I liked the Leviathan. That was the other thing. It kind of reminded me of what Grant Morrison likes to do with his comic books.
Yeah.
Because at one point, you think Tommy is talking to you, the reader.
Yeah.
And then you turn the page and he is, because he's talking to Leviathan.
Yeah, no, that's a classic, you know, the Invisibles move, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's a great book.
And the other one, if you're not really sure on it, I think if you wanted to read, and I don't know if it would work as well without... knowing much about it, but I think if you needed to pick up one issue other than the first issue, which is great, but the Many Lives of Lizzie Hexham, which is the Choose Your Own Adventure one.
That was amazing.
Whoa.
That was, when that issue came out, I was just stunned.
Yeah.
The amount of work that must have taken, like, amazing.
Yeah, I was at, I was at a panel when that had just come out, so I want to say it was like San Diego Comic-Con 2 years ago, and they asked Ryan Wood about that.
Yeah.
Because he had just, like, it had just come out a little while ago, and he did the finishes on it, and he just went, oh my God, it was so hard.
Don't even tell me about that.
And they brought him on because they literally couldn't have done it if they didn't have him finishing it for them.
And that is a straight up, you know, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen move, too, because League did, what, they did the board game in League One, and then... Oh, the amount of work that goes into the back matter in League that Jess Nevins calls Alan Moore's attempt to murder him because he has to, you know, catalog the whole thing. Yeah. It's that level, but it comes out monthly.
Yeah.
Which is something that League does not do.
No. And that's because, for whatever reason, you know, it's Alan Moore and whatever. But I think, as much as I like League, and at least the first two volumes and what little of Black Dossier I've read. Mm-hmm. As much as I like League, I think Unwritten is more collaborative because I think Peter Gross, the artist, does help to plot out and to come up with the stories, whereas, and I don't get me wrong, but I think for League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Alan just gives
Kevin
the script and says, draw it for me.
I would have to assume so as well.
And
also research every... I want every face to look correct. Mm-hmm. Every, you know, 70s sitcom that I'm referring to. Yeah, get that right.
Yeah.
This panel needs to be amazing.
Yeah. Like, from the first issue when, you've read it, so I...
This is called the spoiler show, so this is a place where you can talk about anything you want. You don't have to worry about it.
Well, I'm not going to spoil something, but I think it's interesting. Mm-hmm. The first issue, the first three pages or the first four pages of the first issue is... The book is one of the Tommy Taylor books, right? And it's originally, in the original script, it was...
This is Unwritten, by the way, not League.
Yeah, of Unwritten. The original script was just prose. It was just going to be Mike Carey had written an excerpt from the book, and that's how they were going to start this new comic book.
Yeah.
And Peter Gross, I think rightly, said, I don't know if three pages of prose is the best way to launch your new comic book.
Yeah.
I think... Let me work on it and let me make it comic booky, but still have prose elements in it. And he designed those three pages.
Yeah.
And that is a part of what makes The Unwritten feel like The Unwritten. There's always, every issue or two, there is an excerpt from the Tommy Taylor books that work with the comics medium, but also have chunks of prose that you wouldn't normally get in comics.
Yeah.
It's this really nice marriage of the two. And I think that's entirely Peter Gross's.
It's so disconcerting to hit a big wall of prose if it's not used correctly. Like, I'm thinking that Batman issue that Grant Morrison did about the Joker. Like, I have it. It's Grant Morrison. I like it, but I can't get that far into it. It's just like, you're not a prose stylist. You are great at comic books, Grant Morrison, but this is not, like, your forte.
I stopped reading Batman after that issue. Oh. I've picked up trades since then, but that just made me go, I don't feel comfortable continuing this ride the way you've been doing it.
Yeah.
Like, so I'm done for now.
Like, that's almost, you know, Warren Ellis level, just screw with the audience. I mean...
Don't you dare slight Warren Ellis.
That's my favorite comic book writer. I'm not slighting him. What I'm saying is that Warren Ellis is often kind of... using the medium to kind of mess with you at occasion.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, especially something like Transmet, where the most important issue of the entire thing, you don't even realize until like 40 issues later that this throwaway fun issue that you thought, oh, this is just innocuous. No, that's going to be the main driving storyline going on.
Yeah, but that's good. Like, that lets you go back and reread it. And I think there are things in Unwritten... Going back to that, the fifth issue is the Kipling issue, How the Whale Became.
That was the first time I realized that, like, this one, he's got bigger things going on here because, you know, the first couple, like, the Harry Potter pastiche, books are magic, that's cool. Hey, this is completely different. You've expanded your plot.
Right. But a lot of people read it and went, well, what does this have to do with anything?
Yeah.
And other than, okay, so this has been happening since before now.
Yeah.
But then once you get to the Viathan story arc, you're like, oh, there is a reason that the whale was the story that started off the Just So stories.
Yep.
In this universe, in this fiction creation thing. Things like, things even like Planetary. There's throwaway stuff in Planetary that once you get to the end of Planetary, you're like, well, I have to start this all over again.
Yeah, it's a fractal narrative. My favorite comic is The Invisibles, which is just full of this kind of, you know, this isn't going to be cool now, but wait, it'll be cool later. You just, you know, I'm going to hold your hand here, but, you know, it's definitely very, very, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely that storytelling style that comes out of that, you know, British invasion, I guess.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I've just read the first volume of the Judge Dredd, the Complete Case Files.
Yeah.
So to see 1970s British sci-fi comics.
Yeah.
After reading what came from 1970s British sci-fi comics.
Yeah.
20 years later.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just Judge Dredd, but it's not all the other ones that that have influenced them.
Like Aftershocks.
And, yeah, or Rogue Trooper or Strontium Dog or whatever.
Yeah.
But Judge Dredd is the probably the pinnacle, the tentpole of 2000 AD.
Yeah.
And that's the one British comic book, aside from like the Beano, that people would have heard of.
Yeah.
So that is your reference point for stuff like Hellblazer and Transmetropolitan and even Preacher and and The Invisibles. Like anything that Ellis, Ennis, Morrison, Moore, and those guys were writing all comes from that kind of a style.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to read, you know, these 6-8-page Judge Dredd stories and go, oh, okay, so that's what they were growing up on, and that's what made them write this.
Yeah. We were talking on Twitter about a week ago. You were watching Judge Dredd, the movie, the new one, Dredd 3D, which I thought was excellent, and you seemed to really like as well. But, like, do you think there's something to the idea of Judge Dredd that only makes sense if you're English? Like, it seems like there's a satirical bent on a completely, you know, judge, jury, executioner, fascist regime, you know, cop.
Yeah.
That it feels a little weird to American audiences because the movie did not really do that well here. And I feel like it was a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the thing about The Raid as well. But I don't think The Raid was that huge either. So
no,
when people bring that up, it's like, yeah.
I liked Dredd more than I liked The Raid.
I'd have to watch The Raid again, but I really, really like Dredd.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and if you're going to talk about why doesn't it work in North America, Dredd as a concept works better in Britain because it came from Thatcher.
Yeah.
And then after Thatcher had been in power for a little bit, all of a sudden Reagan comes to power, and then it's not just, oh, the former empire has this crypto-fascist neoconservative.
Yeah.
The actual new empire has this crypto-fascist neoconservative at the helm. So they can look across the Atlantic and satirize a culture that isn't theirs.
There's that, and then, you know, martial law comes out of that as well.
Yeah.
So, but I was thinking, like, watching it again, RoboCop. I think that is the American equivalent to Dredd. I mean, like, you kind of need to like the guy. Whereas Dredd, you like him, but it's like a gallows humor. Like, yeah, Dredd is up against basically the worst things you could imagine. So you kind of have to, you know, at least identify with him a little bit. And if you think about it a little bit, his life is pretty garbage as well.
Like, yeah.
You got to feel for him. Yeah.
And I feel that people, at least when I was growing up, kids who liked RoboCop were liking RoboCop for the wrong reasons. First time I saw RoboCop, I was an adult.
Yeah.
So I watched RoboCop and I went, oh man, if I watched this when I was 12, I would not have gotten this. But my 12-year-old friends who loved RoboCop totally did not understand what RoboCop was supposed to be. And apparently neither did, I don't know, any producer who made any RoboCop movie after RoboCop.
True, yeah. And Frank Miller, I guess.
Yeah. But like RoboCop to me is, you're right, it's a really good example of a Judge Dredd-like character.
I think it's like the American equivalent because you have to have kind of a tragic backstory. You have to actually feel for him. You have to know he had a family.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have to, there's sort of signifiers in place to say, you know, this guy who is going to go blast a bunch of bad guys, you know, he's only doing it because of an evil corporation.
Yeah.
Whereas Dredd, you don't really get that sense. Like, Dredd, you know, he's kind of like bred in he's a clone, I think.
He's a clone, yeah.
So he's like cloned to do a job. He sleeps for like 2 hours a day or something. And he's basically a robot he's a man who is essentially a robot, where, you know, RoboCop is the robot who
wants to be
a man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the early Dredd stuff, it doesn't become super fascist Dredd.
Yeah.
It starts off as a fairly straightforward future cop story.
Interesting.
And even when he starts getting very hard line, and it only really starts happening towards the end of that first season, or the first collection that I have.
Yeah.
He's still got, like, his comedy relief robot manservant, Wobby the Wobot.
Yeah.
And
his catchphrase, you know, You know, I'm going to get you, creeps.
Yeah.
Just throwing out creeps.
Yes. And his relationship with Robbie softens Dredd.
Yeah.
Because, well, and he's so angry at this robot who just wants to, like my favorite joke is at Christmas time, Wobby gives Judge Dredd long underwear with his name embroidered in it. And he's like, Wobby, you know I don't, first of all, you know I don't wear long underwear. And second of all, why do you keep embroidering my name on all of my clothes?
Yeah.
And Robbie says, it's so that when I go to the laundromat, the other Wobots will know that I am Judge Dredd's Wobot.
Oh.
So how do you not really kind of, like, and Judge Dredd keeps him around and likes him. So there is still that humanizing aspect. It's not until later, I think, when Robbie is killed and then forgotten about, that Judge Dredd becomes, you know, completely dead inside.
Yeah.
Which is the Dredd you find in the Dredd
movie. In the movie, yeah.
And some people were saying, oh, it's not funny enough, it's not satirical enough. And I'm like, you can't satirize something that you haven't established.
Exactly. Like, you don't have the background. They don't have enough time in the movie to make you understand that this is supposed to be satirical. That's why RoboCop is amazing, because they are able to, in a short amount of time, get a hero that you feel for, also establish that his entire society is corrupt and awful, like, in, what, an hour and 45 minutes. It's amazing. And, you know, Dredd, I don't think it's quite a RoboCop, but it did about as good as you could with Dredd.
Oh, yeah. And I really would have loved for it to do better. I think part of the reason that Dredd didn't do well as a film in America is because 20 years was not enough to wash the stench of the Stallone movie out of people's brains. And it was fairly low budget. There wasn't a big star.
And Carl Urban kind of, it seems like he just picks genre roles because he likes them.
Yeah, he was great.
He was.
Apparently the voice hurt him to do, and so that's why it's a little inconsistent.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't want a Judge Dredd who takes off his helmet. I don't want a personable Judge Dredd. I want Judge Dredd to go in and kick ass, and Judge Anderson and everyone else is there to respond to Judge
Dredd. To look horrified, like, oh, can't believe you did that. Like, well, I'm the law. It's just what I do.
It's just what I do. But even he changes from the beginning to the end of the movie, because at the beginning of the movie, it's the law is the law and the rules are the rules and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And at the end, it's like, no, I'll bend this one rule for Anderson.
Yeah.
That's a character arc for Judge Dredd.
Yeah, that's all he's going to do. Like, he's not going to have a change of heart or anything. He has to go to another situation that is equally horrible in the next 15 minutes. I mean,
yeah, like to be fair, Mama's tower is pretty awful.
It's pretty bad, but I can't imagine the rest of Dredd's day was much better.
Like, yeah, he is the kind of dude that he's the kind of judge who will come across those things more and more. And I kind of see him as maybe an early Judge Dredd, and then a sequel that will never come because they're auctioning off all the stuff.
Oh.
Yeah. But I think that if they were to do a sequel, you could get into a slightly more hardened Judge Dredd, and you could do a little bit more about the politics of Mega City 1. But for an attempt to wipe the slate clean and to set a ground, like a foundation for a future series, I think Dredd was fantastic.
Yeah.
Let alone, was it super entertaining?
Yes.
The other thing that, the only reason I didn't see it in the theater was because it was in 3D.
Yeah. And the 3D, it was one of the few uses of 3D that I didn't absolutely despise. I mean, that one, and I guess Avatar, even though I didn't really like the movie, the 3D, like, worked for it. And Tintin, actually.
Yeah, Tintin. And Hugo.
Hugo used it intelligently and kind of used it to change perspective for the characters. Or here's an interesting thing in the way of the action. But Dredd in 3D, just the 3D, like, the slow-mo scenes, is horrible violence is happening. That's something I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
And I'll give it that. I'm not a big fan of 3D at all, but yeah, it worked out pretty well.
Yeah. So Judge Dredd, super good.
Yeah. So what else have you been reading lately?
Well, you've been asking me a lot of questions. Why don't you tell me something you've been reading recently?
Oh, well, I don't know. We could segue into the book club for a little bit.
Sure. Yeah.
So as longtime spoiler show listeners of the last 2 weeks will know, this month we are doing Naomi Novik's His Majesty's Dragon for the book club. You read it?
Nope. Devin is putting that into his phone.
Yeah, it's right there if you want to see it. It's a fantasy series that postulates, what if, sentient dragons were around during the Napoleonic War?
Oh.
And each country has their own breeds of dragon that they have. They have, you know, different capabilities. The main one, Temeraire, is a especially rare Chinese dragon who's kind of adopted by a British naval commander, very Horatio Hornblower, who kind of comes across it and it imprints on him. And these dragons are fitted out like B-52 bombers. So they're rolling above the battlefields of Europe, dropping bombs. They, you know, do boarding parties against each other. It's just fantastic fun. And we're going to be talking about it at the end of this month. So probably 2 weeks from now, you'll have our rundown on the book. But check it out. You can either ask Marcus or myself if you have any discussion questions, you want to talk about it. It's great fun. Naomi Novik actually used to live in Edmonton, so that's a cool little tidbit. She worked with BioWare. That's why she was here. I think she worked on Neverwinter Nights.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, she's made all these books now. And the thing that kind of made them so popular is that they were optioned by Peter Jackson. Mm. So back when The Hobbit was going to be one movie as opposed to three gigantic films, like an Odyssey of Hobbitry, this was going to be the next film that he did. And I still hope he does it because there is a lot of dramatic, you know, potential in, you know, Master and Commander riding on top of a dragon.
Yeah.
It's a great idea. And I hope it happens. But yeah, that's what we're reading this month.
Well, I will try and read it in the next 2 weeks and then try and be part of the discussion because that sounds good. Fantasy books, as a kid, I read a lot of fantasy books, and as an adult, I kind of get away from it because I find a lot of it the same or boring.
Yeah.
But I mean, that seems like an interesting twist on it.
So. It's closer to the Horatio Hornblower or that's Patrick O'Brien, right?
Yeah.
I think so. And then there's the Flashman books.
Oh, yeah. I've never read those, but they looked really good.
They do look really good. I've read a little bit of them, and I feel like if I was to go that way, I would go whole hog and read all 20 of them or so.
Yeah.
So I just need to book off a year where I'm able to do that.
And then just go to Bernard Cornwell and read all the Sharp novels and then...
Yeah. So if you're into that sort of military fiction, this is closer to that, I'd say. And there's, you know, interesting sort of... The fact that it's set in the real world, I think, is definitely the thing that sets this one apart because it's essentially an alternate history. It's closer to Harry Turtledove.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, you get... Or the little-known Orson Scott Card books, the Alvin Maker novels, if you've read those. Just kind of, you know, what would it be like if we had some magic element in our history? And this one does not really go into fantasy tropes. I mean, it is a reluctant hero, but he's not exactly Thomas Covenant or something. Mm. So I would definitely recommend it. You can blow through them in 2 hours, too.
Cool.
They're a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So... I don't know what else I've been reading lately. Lately, I've been reading a lot of David Mitchell.
That's not a name I'm familiar with.
Did you see the movie Cloud Atlas?
No, but I want to.
Definitely check out Cloud Atlas because David Mitchell, excellent writer. I read Cloud Atlas before and after I watched the movie. I read about half of it, then I watched the movie, then I read the rest of it. Then I read his other one, Black Swan Green, which is a coming-of-age tale in England during the Falklands War. Hmm. Kid, yeah, has to deal with that. And now I'm reading The Sows and Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, which is about a clerk of the Dutch East India Company who lives on this, apparently real, there was a trading island that only, that traders from the outside world were allowed to go to called Dejima, which is across from Nagasaki. So when, you know, after Commodore Perry had opened up Japan. No, this is before Commodore Perry. But like when Japan was just kind of making feelers into the Western world and starting to trade a little bit, there was a trading island that if you were a foreigner, that's where you lived.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about kind of, Dutch people on this island coming up against the sort of restrictive shogunate regime. And yeah, it's pretty entertaining. So fish out of water story, you get some history there. I've been enjoying his work a lot.
Nice.
I also went to the bookstore and picked up Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel. Her latest one, Bring Up the Bodies, just won the Booker Prize.
Oh, wow.
It's a history of Thomas Cromwell as a political manipulator behind the scenes in Henry VIII's England.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to digging into that one. But, yeah. Yeah. So.
Read Gun Machine.
I read Gun Machine 2 weeks
ago. You already read it? Oh, I haven't finished it yet.
I bought it. I had it pre-ordered on my iPad.
Nice.
And I started reading it on New Year's Eve because...
I started reading on New Year's Day!
Yeah. So I was basically just waiting for it to, like, just... Oh, is it ready yet? No. Is it ready yet? No. Is it ready yet? And I blew through it in, like, 2 days. And it was great. I really, really liked it.
So good.
I think I like Crooked Little Vein more, but this is just, like, just a tinge less.
I think I thought Crooked Little Vein was okay, but I didn't think he really had, I don't think he'd really figured out the pacing for prose.
True.
Quite yet.
And Gun Machine is pretty well timed. Like, it's a pretty, like, neat little thriller.
Yeah, and it's him marrying, it's Warren Ellis marrying his voice, his very obvious Ellis voice with hard-boiled crime, and it works really well. Like, Bat and Scarly are very Ellis-y.
Yeah.
But everything else is very hard-boiled and one man up against the world noir kind of stuff.
The hunter, the serial killer in this book, is definitely kind of a, like, that's not an Ellisian character, really. This is kind of completely out of his gourd. And I especially really liked the NYPD's attitude towards finding 200 new cases. Like, nope, fuck it, we don't care about this shit.
Yeah.
You should have not gone in there.
Yeah.
We were perfectly fine with the amount of unsolved murders we had. You have opened up a whole can of worms.
That's something I love about, like, really good police...
Yeah.
Police stories. Not necessarily crime stories, but police stories.
Well, it was essentially The Wire, where...
The Wire or Homicide or anything like that, where you come across... Like, I like Law & Order, but the cops in Law & Order... Each case means something to them.
Yeah.
And in The Wire or Homicide, it is rare that a case means something to them. It is mostly, this is our job. Oh, great. Look how much, you know, like the red and the black on the case whiteboard, which they had to get rid of in Baltimore.
They did?
Yeah. They got rid of it.
Because of
The Wire? In real life. Because of Homicide.
Oh.
Because people saw it and they were like, that doesn't really exist, does it? And then the Baltimore Police Department was like, no, it doesn't. No, it actually does. And then everyone was like, that's a really shitty way to do your job.
Yeah.
So they got rid of it.
But imagine this, like, you know, imagine if you're at your work and they just dropped, you know, 200 more tasks for you to do.
Yeah.
Like, it's a job. That's something that most, well, like Law & Order especially, yeah, it's not a passion. It's just what you do every day.
Mm-hmm.
And the rare person is the McNulty who just gets so into a case that this happens. And John Tallow in Gun Machine is that sort of guy because in his case, he has nothing to lose.
Yeah.
He's basically going to be retired forcefully. He's just flaming out.
Yeah.
This is his last big stab at it. And that's such a great... narrative arc that rarely gets tapped into. Usually it's the dogged detective who just has to solve something.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, flaming out.
Flaming out, and then I just got to the part where he's like, I don't remember who it was, but it was not the lieutenant, but one of the people above the lieutenant who said, I wasn't a good police detective until I got a shitty partner.
Yeah.
And then I started really... figuring out how the job works.
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing now, Tallow. You have no partner, so now you have to do it all yourself. You have to wake up. You have to look at it.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting. And the thing that you said that about, you know, the people who are the ones that are... Who it's rare that they'll find their passion in it.
Yeah.
And most people just look at it as a job. I think that's why in the history of Law & Order, Jerry Orbach's character was the best.
Yeah.
Because he was... gruff and it's just another job, and then he kind of turned it to humor because he was old and he'd done this for a really long time. But every once in a while there would be that case that would make his character go, no, all of a sudden this is important and I need you. But every other time it was just, yep, I'm doing my job, here's a wry one-liner, let's go.
Or he's just concerned about, like, man, this is delicious pizza.
Yeah.
Or, you know, where do we get coffee around here?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a murder? Okay, well, we'll figure that out too.
So much.
But going back to Crooked Little Vein, I feel like the amount of Ellisian weirdness in Crooked Little Vein, that's what I wanted from an Ellis book.
Mm.
And Gun Machine, as much as I like it, it does have this sort of family of weirdos coming together, like an Ellis, you know, tale does. But it just doesn't go as weird enough. Like,
to me, I think that, and I'm going to make a weird comparison, but I think Crooked Little Vein is to Transmetropolitan what Gun Machine is to Planetary.
That is quite a statement.
Right? Like, the weirdness of of Transmetropolitan is out on its sleeve.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Crooked Little Vein, where it's like, yep, look at this weird stuff, Godzilla Bukkake, and, yeah, and I'm going to shoot stuff into your eye and cut off things. Like
the secret constitution of the United States, printed on the back of an alien.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Yeah. But that is Transmet.
Yeah.
And then Planetary is him going, I want to try something different, and I'm mm-hmm. going to be a little more subtle about it, and
yeah,
I'm going to try something different. And I like familiarity. I like Transmet. I will go back to Transmet
yeah.
over and over again. But as much as I like Transmetropolitan, when I actually sit down to read Planetary, I'm always so much more impressed.
Planetary is one of the great comics works
mm-hmm.
total. I mean, it... In itself, just like League, just like Unwritten, it is an entire universe unto itself.
Mm-hmm. And it's a meta story about comics and pulp fiction and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so, it's a, like, the fact that he pulled it off, and John Cassaday.
Yeah, yeah. Laura Martin.
Yeah, it took forever to do, and, you know, it was kind of like a joke for a while, like, oh yeah, yeah, sure, the solicit for Planetary, yeah, don't even worry about that.
Yeah.
I remember ordering it. Like, yeah, this is not going to show up.
It was a joke when the solicits came out.
Yeah.
But when the issue comes out,
you're like, oh, this is exactly why I remember this was great. Because
yeah.
it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so good. And that's why I think that... I'm not saying that they're better, you know, like they're... But it's... Gun Machine is more like Planetary in the sense that I want to try something very specific. I want
yeah.
to make... In Gun Machine, I want to make an American crime novel for the 21st century using those kinds of thoughts, but
using ideas from the 16th century.
Yeah, and using ideas from the 16th century, but using character tropes
yeah.
from the 50s, the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
which is very similar to his Planetary stuff. I'm going to use these character tropes from there to
True.
Tell the new stories.
Yeah.
And so that's why I made that.
And I hope Gun Machine, I've heard it's been doing really well, really well. I hope he does a follow-up because, you know, there's nothing like a mystery series to ensure a long, long, long life for the author
mm-hmm.
making lots of money.
Yeah.
So that's what Warren Ellis should be. He should be, you know, making great books and making a lot of money out of it.
Yeah.
I hope he is able to continue doing that and maybe make some comics along the way, too, because I don't want him to leave entirely.
No, I think he'll... I don't know. Does he still have the house painting job at Marvel?
I don't know. What was the last thing he did?
Thunderbolts?
Thunderbolts?
I can't think of a thing that he's done at Marvel since.
Yeah.
I think he's probably kind of quietly just walked away from that. But, I mean, like, if he... Like, and he comes out with some stuff from Avatar or whatever, and that's great. But, I mean, he's been working on his books, and if that's what he wants to do, great. Like, if he can continue to write good stuff...
Yeah.
I'll wait for whatever it is.
And they're a much more secure revenue stream than comics.
Yeah.
Like, the Avatar stuff... Kind of hit and miss for me. I really liked Super Gods. That was another
yeah.
sort of great out there idea that only Warren Ellis could do. Captain Swing definitely suffered from the time delay.
Mm-hmm.
That one, you know.
But, like, Etheric Mechanics, I really liked.
Etheric Mechanics was really cool. And I wish he kept going with that format of, like, the, what, 60-page graphic novella.
Frankenstein's Womb?
Frankenstein's Womb, that was pretty cool. I keep equating in my head to, the Light of Her Countenance, the Alan Moore one that kind of came out at the same time. They feel like they had more in common than Etheric Mechanics did, really?
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. But yeah, like his Avatar stuff, it seems like a really good creative outlet for him. I would like to see him on another long running series, but yeah, he knows what side his bread is buttered on. So
yeah. definitely.
But I know we were talking about this a little bit before, but Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
What's the problem there? What is happening? Because they're canceling all the things I like,
mm-hmm.
and they can't seem to keep anything going at all.
Yeah.
I mean, American Vampire is probably the flagship now.
Well, the three long run... Now that Hellblazer's over,
yeah.
which we'll get into.
That's bullshit.
yeah. But the three longest running series that are there are... what is it? Unwritten, Fables, and American Vampire.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I can't think of another one that's a continuing series.
Yeah.
And yeah, American Vampire's on hiatus, but...
True, yeah.
It isn't canceled. I think there's a lot there. For the longest time, Vertigo was it. Like, yeah, okay, we'll do some Marvel stuff, we'll do some DC stuff, and this is back when Dark Horse was pretty much just Hellboy,
yeah.
And Image was pretty much
But Vertigo's nothing. The place to be. You got Preacher, you got Invisibles, you've got just so much...
Transmetropolitan.
Well, there's Helix first.
Well, yeah, but I mean, 7 issues later, it's Vertigo. And Hellblazer was still good, and I think
Hellblazer is actually... the best it's been in a long time.
Oh, I love Hellblazer. Even,
but like
even
this,
the issue.
This current arc.
Yeah. Milligan's doing some good stuff.
Yeah. Like, did you read the last one?
No, because I've been putting it off.
Yeah, it is painful, but like him and Giuseppe Camicoli, I think they are like one of the classic Hellblazer teams.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But yeah, like all that stuff was, it clearly was Karen Berger,
yeah,
right?
That
was her deal. Like, she's like, yeah. I want you, and I want you, and I want you. Pitch me stuff, and I'll do whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that when... and Vertigo was the name, and I think DC was like, okay, we'll kind of let you do your own thing, and that's what... And even, like, Scalped.
Yeah,
and
Scalped was amazing. I love Scalped.
Like, up until Scalped, and then that was when I noticed something was not going right at Vertigo, was when Jason Aaron... writer of Scout starts writing for Marvel Comics. And
true.
I'm like, why did DC Comics not pick you up?
Yeah, that seems like a oversight because
why
he goes off to do Wolverine the X-Men, which has
no,
been...
No, not even that. Like he, what did he do when... it wasn't even Wolverine and the X-Men. Like, he'd got Wolverine and the X-Men after 2 years. He'd been at Marvel. He's been at Marvel for a really long time.
Did he do some of the, Nation X stuff?
Yeah, I don't know. He did, Astonishing Wolverine and Spider-Man. And
Ghost Rider.
Ghost Rider, yeah.
There it is, yeah.
So, the fact that Marvel got him and DC didn't get him was a big warning
sign. That's a clue, yeah. Yeah, it's true.
And I think it was because Dan DiDio didn't like that Karen Berger had control.
Yeah.
And I think that he kind of cut off his nose to spite his face in that scenario.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, Karen and Dan DiDio kept saying, oh, you know, I'm not going to do my Dan DiDio impression because it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
But, you know, he has to reinvigorate his superhero lines, and he's doing whatever, for better or for worse. Some of it's good, some of it's not so great.
True.
And then when Warner Brothers starts looking at comics as story generation for alternative revenue streams, they're going to take... Dan DiDio and Jeff Johns and say, Dan DiDio and Jim Lee, you're in charge of all of the comics now. And Dan DiDio gets to go, oh, finally, now I'm your boss. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to tell you what to do.
So
and
you think it was a power play?
I don't want to pretend that I'm an insider that knows something, but very clearly those two did not get along.
Yeah.
And she was always very clear that he wasn't her boss, that they were equals reporting to whomever. And then whenever he became her boss, Vertigo, whose star had already kind of been falling, but was still doing fairly well.
Yeah.
Was also kind of being eclipsed by Image as the new young, this is where people go to write their creator own stuff.
Yeah.
So those two things kind of happening in tandem, the Dan DiDio becoming in charge of all of DC Comics and Image going, we've got Chew and we've got, Jonathan Hickman stuff and
Morning Glories
and we've got Butcher Baker, the Righteous Maker. And
that was
got
a great
all
book.
These, all
Butcher
these,
Baker was great. Yeah.
But like Butcher Baker would have been a perfect Vertigo book.
No, that would have been,
Chew
that would have
is
been
a perfect
fine.
Vertigo book.
Chew was pitched as a Vertigo book.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And Image is kind of picking up the scraps and now Image is the Vertigo of our
I believe
this
it.
Comic
yeah.
book generation.
Yeah.
And Vertigo's just like, basically, it's just name.
Is it vestigial now?
Yeah, I think it really is. Like, it's still an important imprint that DC wants because it's DC. It's like what Touchstone was to Disney. Like, it's like their boutique imprint that they can remember when we did this and you know, put Vertigo down your spine and it's going
to
be cool.
Well, I also have to say, like, when I was managing the store, Vertigo was the most reliable backlist player. I mean, nothing sells like a Vertigo title. If you get someone hooked, they will buy the entirety of it. Preacher or, you know, Northlanders. If you get someone on those...
DMZ,
yeah. Like, the storytelling they were doing there, they were the HBO of comics. And it was just the most reliable earner that we had in store, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it probably still is, but... nothing seems to be picking up the slack there. I mean, American Vampire did quite well while I was there, and I'm sure it's probably doing well now, but none of the other things really seem to be catching on, and they're canceling a bunch of the things too, which is very disconcerting.
When you said Northlanders, it just reminded me. Remember when I said, why was Jason Aaron writing for Marvel when he was doing Scout? Where's Paul Cornell now?
Paul Cornell
writing Wolverine.
True, yeah.
What was Saucer, his last DC
Saucer
book?
Country.
Saucer Country. Where's Brian Wood now?
He's doing The Massive and Mara and Star Wars.
And X-Men.
And X-Men, yeah.
Like, I think Joe Quesada or someone at Marvel, Axel Alonso even, who used to be an editor at Vertigo.
That's was probably like, it, actually. Alonso like, knew it, had all the contacts.
Hot writer.
Yeah.
Grab them because they're not on an exclusive. Let's put them on an exclusive at Marvel. And
yeah, let's eat DC's lunch.
Yeah.
And, I can believe that.
That's just poaching from them, treating them well.
Yeah.
And saying, yeah, I know you don't really, I'm sure Paul Cornell never woke up as a kid and went, boy, I'd like to write Wolverine. But yeah.
As an English boy growing up, I feel that Wolverine and I have a kindred spirit.
But, like, the fact that he willingly jumped ship when he was doing really, probably two of my favorite books for the New 52.
Mm-hmm.
And just was like, no, I'm going to go do Wolverine because I bet Marvel gives him a better deal.
And you would definitely get paid a lot more if you were writing Wolverine.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just, but I mean, and Hellblazer.
Let's do a little cheers for Hellblazer because it's going away and it makes me very sad.
Makes me sad too. Hellblazer and Transmetropolitan are the two, I didn't sip, hold on.
There we go. This one's for John.
That's right. Those are the two books that, that's the reason I'm reading comics again.
Yeah.
There was a while there that I was only reading Transmetropolitan.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was in the store, I'm like, okay, so comics aren't all bad, like I thought they were.
Yeah.
Let's look around. And I saw the cover for the, I don't remember the issue, but I think it's in the 150s because it was when Azzarello was writing it. The Blackwater? No. That's Loveless. But the one where
John
goes,
jail, yeah.
No, after he's in jail, after he gets out of jail.
In the shitty little southern town?
Goes to the shitty little southern town with the neo-Nazis.
Yeah.
And the Tim Bradstreet cover with the neo-Nazi
those were great.
Imagery, I was just like, that looks like nothing that's on the shelf right now. And it's Vertigo,
yeah.
So I already feel an affinity with that.
Yeah.
I'll pick it up. And that's why I started reading comics again.
That's about where I started reading. Like, one thing that I wish that they would do, and I've mentioned it, like, when I would be at cons before and at the Vertigo panels, they would say like, "Oh, what do you think we should do? Showcase Hellblazer."
Well, Showcase Hellblazer or numbered Hellblazer.
They are doing them, but it's coming out extremely slowly.
Yeah,
and I feel like it should be like the Invisible's Tokyo Telephone Book edition of Hellblazer. Mm-hmm. You should be able to catch up on it more because I would like to get back to that stuff, but there's just no real achievable way of doing so.
Yeah, and I'm doing my best. Like I have the Fear Machine. I just finished the Fear Machine and Family Man in the past month.
Yeah,
so I'm catching up. That's the nice thing about Hellblazer is that it is a continuity, but they don't treat it. They're not slavish about it.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, a writer will be like, "Hey, remember that character from Delano's run? I would like to use that character for a little bit."
And they'll explain who it is, which is John Constantine, you fucked me over this way.
Yeah. Or Chaz shows up and he hasn't been in like 20 issues, but yeah. Chaz shows up and okay, it's his cabbie friend, whatever.
Yeah.
And I know why they're canceling it, and it's a shitty reason, but from a cultural reader appreciation standpoint, but from a marketing standpoint,
yeah,
you can't have two versions of the same character if you're trying to sell that character to anyone.
Yeah, it was the beginning of the end, that stupid Search for Swamp Thing.
Search for Swamp Thing. I was right super excited.
Yeah.
Like, when I first saw it, I'm like, oh my god, John Constantine's back in the regular DC universe?
Hey, and it sucked. It was awful.
It sucks.
Yeah.
And, young, cool, hip Constantine, which is okay. And I'm saying teen because that's how I started. I know it's pronounced time.
Rhymes with wine.
I know.
Yeah.
Young, cool, hip John is light.
Yeah.
And I get that, you know, Vertigo John has aged.
Yeah.
And is now one of the 60s.
One of the few people who has aged in comics. I think Dread ages as well. But not too many other ones do.
No. And that's the
Punisher
other
during Ennis's run probably did.
Is that happening anymore?
No, it's not. Yeah.
Because you can do things with an aging character that you can't do with a character who's eternally youthful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like a John Constantine time who was a punk rocker in the 70s and in a mental institution in the 80s.
A punk rocker in a period at which it made sense to be one.
Yeah.
And you actually get a lot of entertaining detail because you can go back in time. As I don't know if you got to that point yet, but when John Constantine's new wife goes back in time
and sleeps with young John.
Yeah, that was like, that is an amazing issue. Yeah. He's kind of pissed off about it, but he's also like, well, at least I was happy at one point.
Yeah. And that's so, it's so nice to have a rich history to pull from. That is why Hellblazer works. That Warren Ellis's 10-issue aborted run felt like Delano.
Yeah.
But updated. And it didn't feel like Garth Ennis, which I think is kind of what they were like, oh, we're going to have to be slavish to Garth Ennis. And then all of a sudden it was like, no, it doesn't have to be this. And then you have Azzarello writing it. You have an American writer writing John Constantine. And he just goes, you know what? I'm not, first of all, I don't know enough about London. Second of all, drive me crazy to start researching all this
stuff.
Let's
go to America.
Let's bring him to America. I know about this. It's going to be interesting to have an outsider's viewpoint on America, and he can use him. And he can use John to be whatever that writer wants him to be, and it always works.
Yeah, I mentioned this on Twitter when we were both talking to James Leask and Brendan Schatz about it.
Mm-hmm.
But Hellblazer is the sort of the school for training up English writers especially, and some American writers like Azzarello. This is where you send them to understand how to be really, really good at comics.
Yeah.
Because you have a rich backstory to draw upon. It's basically like X-Men was in the 80s, where, you know, you've got the soap opera elements, you can do any sort of, you know, in Hellblazer's case, mystical element you want, but you have to learn how to keep getting it out on time and doing a good job.
Yeah, and it was.
Yeah.
And now that Vertigo isn't as important anymore, it's not as important anymore. Like, they got Peter Milligan. Peter Milligan's established.
Yeah.
I thought, honestly, Denise Mina,
she was good.
She did a decent job for someone who's never written comics before.
Yeah.
Getting her feet wet. Give her a Hellblazer, because it'll sell.
Yeah.
Do something different and interesting. It's the first prose writer. It's the first woman writer.
Yeah.
Like, that's really cool. It wasn't entirely successful, but not, you know, Hellblazer is always a jumble of not entirely successful. Even The Fear Machine, which I just read, the first three issues of The Fear Machine, I'm like, I don't know where this is going. And then that was kind of like, okay, we needed him to do this for this one plot point to work, and now we're going to put him and do the rest of it, and then it's fine.
But like, you're watching people develop their craft, and again, like the longest running series, Fables, it's Willingham's baby. No one else is going to write that. I mean, Sturgis did with Jack of Fables for a while, and it was pretty good. And I guess Ferrest, they're doing that a little bit. I dropped off Ferrest. Once you get to the Beauty and the Beast, Beauty turns into a femme fatale every 50 years, and Beast has to go track her down. Like, yeah, that kind of sucked. I'm done with this.
I think I read the first couple issues, and I was okay with continuing to read it.
You're fine. It was completely skippable. Another sort of vestigial part of Fables. That Fables is kind of an amazing creature when you think about it. Like, it's gone on for quite a long time in modern standards. There's so many offshoots of it. It continues to impress me, but it is not the factory for pumping out good writers that Hellblazer is, because it can't be.
And it could have been, because Chris Roberson's Cinderella stories
were great. They were fantastic.
And then he got so upset by how he was being treated by DC that he left and created his own awesome comic book company.
Yeah, he made his own company.
Because guess what? If you don't treat your creators well, they will leave you.
The Cinderella stories, I should mention, here are two spy outings. Fables Are Forever, and I think from Fable Town with Love was the first one. They were excellent.
The covers make it look way cheesecakeier than it actually is. But I love Chris Cizulo's covers, but it does make it look like, sexiness will be found inside.
Yeah, Aaron and I met her just before the first issue came out.
Mm.
So it was kind of funny it was funny in a sad way, much like most comic book stories are, because they were using the cover of the first Cinderella on the big banner at DC, but then Zulu's at her own table, and completely cut out, essentially, which, depressing nature of comic book sales. The business is going to break your heart every single time.
Yeah, and I mean, I know we're talking about Hellblazer, and we'll get back to it, but I think that's something, honestly, I am much more a fan of DC characters than I am of Marvel characters. Yeah. But at least Marvel seems like a community. Yeah. Like, their creative teams, the creative people seem like a community.
They have the editorial outings, they go out and talk to each other.
The writers seem to get along, and everyone kind of seems on the same page. To me, Marvel feels like they have a barbecue every weekend.
Yeah.
And DC gets a form letter from the company, the head of the company at Christmas.
Yeah. Saying you're fired.
Saying, thank you for your work, but we are firing you in an email until the internet gets angry and we're hiring you back.
The Gail Simone. that's what they call that one back at DC headquarters. Yeah. They call that the Gail Simone.
Well, it was previously known as the Mark Waid.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a classic move. But Hellblazer, I'm going to miss it. Kevin Coley is one of my favorite artists. Total.
And I forgot, like, he was doing some of the art when Azzarello was writing it, right?
Yeah.
So the fact that he came back and I'm like, oh, it's so cool. Like, his John still kind of looks the same, but he's a little bit older. And who's the other guy who's doing the art for it sometimes?
Oh.
The guy who's doing almost all the covers and he sometimes does intern.
Beisley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His stuff is so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hellblazer is the best it's been in a while. And it hasn't been bad. It's just been, you know, acceptable Hellblazer levels.
See, when I was back at the store, I loved ordering Hellblazer. You know why? You order the same amount every single month. It does not... The quality is always sufficient that no one is going to drop it. Not a lot of people are adding it, but it's consistent, which is better than 90% of the comic books out there because they will fluctuate so rapidly that you have to stay on top. But Hellblazer, boom, same number every time.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that. And you think the market would appreciate that, but you know, it never is going to sell Blockbuster.
Unless Azzarello's writing it.
Unless Azzarello's writing it. But I think consistency is something the current comics scape needs, and they don't seem to realize that. They think, you know, as much as I enjoy Justice League Dark, but I don't think that version of Constantine needs his own comic.
Yeah. I don't either, but I might get it because I don't want to dismiss it outright. It's got two good writers on it.
Well, it was going to have one good writer, and then they switched them out.
Well, no, but isn't it Guy Fawkes and Jeff Lemire writing it?
Yeah, but it was going to be Robert Venditti first, and then they did a classic DC maneuver of, no, that actually was not happening.
No.
April Fools.
But I don't want to dismiss it out of hand. It's not the character that I'd necessarily want to see. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a bad comic book.
Yeah.
Would I rather them have Hellblazer go to issue 500?
Yeah.
Of course I would.
Yeah.
But we are, and I don't mean we as comic book writers, we as enjoyers of popular culture, it's always what the next big thing is. And we've trained producers of the, and producers I mean in a general, but also movie
Hollywood producers
to salivate like Pavlov's dog for the next big thing.
Yeah.
And they'll see a blip of creativity that people react to, and then they'll go, oh, if they want more of that, and they'll make 100 of those, and they'll destroy themselves.
Yeah,
we've trained them to do that.
Yeah, as much as we've been talking about the shittiness of editorial at DC, I feel that Marvel is in that quadrant if regards to their mainline superheroes. I mean, the funniest recap page that I can ever recall seeing was Gorilla Man trying to recap the events of the Marvel Universe. So it essentially went, we had House of M, and then we had a Secret Invasion, and then we had another thing and another thing. And that's all it was. I mean, Marvel, I feel like when a good creator and good creators have a book, it's great. But the entire scape of the comics, you know, their universe... So pegged to events that it just disgusts me, honestly.
Yeah, and I've kind of given up on that. And I mean, I don't think I'm the kind of person who, like a lot of people I know who they vacillate between, I'm not reading any superhero comics versus, oh my God, superhero comics are great again.
Yeah.
For a while there, until the New 52 started, it was like, I'm only reading B and C list heroes. I'm not reading Superman. I'm not reading Batman. Yeah. I'm not reading...
You're reading Captain Britain and MI-13?
Yeah, Captain Britain and MI-13. And I'm reading...
I could just tell.
Hercules. And I'm reading Hercules. And I'm reading Birds of Prey. Like, yeah. I like all those little niche things because you have a little more free reign. The characters are interesting. You can still do interesting stuff. Every once in a while, there's a tie-in, so Spider-Man might come or whatever. Yeah. Like, those are the kinds of things that I like. Now, yeah, let's be fair. I really, right now, the only Marvel comics that I'm buying, all of the proceeds go to the Fraction DeConnick household. Because I'm reading Hawkeye, Fantastic Four, FF, and Captain Marvel.
Not Wolverine and the X-Men?
No.
Have you tried it?
I don't care. I'll read Uncanny X-Force when it comes out, because that book ruled.
X-Force was amazing. The fact that they put Bishop in the new one, that was a deal breaker for me.
See, I like Bishop from the 90s.
I don't.
And I like Law and Order Bishop. Yeah. I love, what was it called? District X.
Oh, Bishop. Yeah.
And I'm like, that's the Bishop I want to see.
Oh, is it that Bishop?
It's not, but I'm hoping that somehow Sam Humphries can turn him back into that Bishop.
It's not. And I have to blow up a baby Bishop.
Yeah. And it's got Puck.
True. Puck, who has fought his way out of hell.
I'm sold. You put Puck in a book.
And no one believes him as well. That's the best part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't. Wolverine the X-Men, whatever. I'm sure it's great. But
I would check that one out, because while I was reading most of Marvel's output when I was at the store, Wolverine the X-Men stood out in that I didn't actually need to read the rest of it to care about what was going on, as opposed to, say, the entirety of Brian Michael Bendis' work.
Yeah.
Which is so reliant on, we need to, you know, read everything.
And that's okay. And you know what? I like that he's gone away from Avengers and he gets to do the kind of books that I'm actually more interested in reading.
Like Powers?
No, like Guardians of the Galaxy. Bendis on Guardians of the Galaxy will be interesting.
Yeah.
And even I'm not going to read it, but the concept of time shunted into the future, young X-Men having to deal with the world that they've created for their children to inherit.
Yeah.
Like, that's a cool idea.
Here is how Jason Aaron makes that idea better. Because he has Quentin Quire try and hit on 60s Jean Grey. She's also telepathic. They have a telepathic battle, and then they kind of just come to an agreement. Like, yeah, okay, this is what the future is like. We have Quentin Quire, mutant terrorist, who is now a student at the Jean Grey school, which is also weird for her.
Yeah.
But, like, Jason Aaron, he is able to take that history and not slavishly devote to it in such a way that I think you should check it out.
Okay, and I was reading, I started the Hickman F Fantastic Four way back when. Stopped reading it because I just wasn't feeling it.
Yeah.
But then I picked up a bunch of the Hickman FF issues, and I was like, whoa, this got amazing!
That's one that definitely reads better afterwards, because it is such a huge tapestry that you need the entirety of it to appreciate it. But here's how I will sell you on Wolverine the X-Men.
Oh, sell me on it.
There is an entire issue about Dupe.
Yeah, I know, and it's written and it's drawn by Michael Allred.
Drawn by Michael Allred. And Dupe is the super sexy secret agent who basically cleans up all the messes that Wolverine and the X-Men can't even deal with. He gets in a guitar battle with, I believe it's Satanish. It's either that or Blackheart. Like, one of the weird, you know, demon characters you'll get in Marvel. He gets in a guitar battle off. This is one page of the issue.
Yeah.
Like, the creativity flowing out of this is amazing.
Yeah, and that was one of the issues that made me go, well, I might buy that issue. But again, I'm just... X-Men is like a safe word for me. Like, it's like, oh, I'm done. Nope. X-Men, nope. No thank you.
Nope. Okay. That's... I can understand that. I mean, if you want something that is as tied to events as possible, X-Men. Yeah.
But at the very least, you've sold me on at least getting the Dupe issue. At the very least. And I do want to say, I know we probably need to wrap this up at some point, and I know I have to sell you on something, but I do want to talk about non-Big Two comics for a little bit if we can.
Yep, that's always a nice thing to do. That's most of my comic buying is based in that quadrant, but yeah.
Yeah.
Go on.
Monkey Brain.
Yes, yes.
So good.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, like, no, they've been, for a company that has existed, what, 3 months?
They came out last summer, so still, 6 months.
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. They have good writers. They're not huge. I mean, the biggest ones would be like Paul Tobin and Colleen Coover and
In Bandette, right?
Yeah, and Bandette's so fun.
Yeah.
It's like Tintin, but with a lady robber.
Yeah.
But that's the other great thing about Monkey Brain is that not everything is the same, and it feels like, okay, well, do you like this? Right, Bandette. Do you like crime? Get, what is it, Gangsters and, or Capes and, oh, now I've forgotten what it is, but it's, Masks and Mobsters.
Yeah.
Which I also really like.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy the concepts of superheroes, but, you know, are okay with tongue-in-cheek? Get Edison Rex. Do you like their fantasy?
Their Free Comic Book Day one coming out, forget the name of it, but like 60s super spy kind of cool shit. That looks pretty great as well. I mean, yeah, they're definitely a great place for creators to just cut loose and play with concepts that we know from other things.
Yeah. Kevin Church doing, I can't remember, but the one where, because I read them all, but I have a hard time remembering the name. The one where she's a grad student who gets sucked into a fantasy book.
I keep getting that confused with Memorial because that's Robertson writing it.
Yeah.
But I know the one you're talking about.
Yeah, and Amelia Cole in The Unknown World is a girl who's used to going in a world where there is absolutely no magic and a world where there is magic, and now she's trapped in this third weird place. Like, every book is good, and it's so rare to find something like that.
That is, I think that's the strength of strong editorial that has worked in the industry, realizes the things that you need to keep, you know, ongoing comics going, but is able to weed out 50 years of history because you don't necessarily need to have 5 X-Men books, for instance.
Yeah. And some... Just, oh, sorry, go ahead.
You can just have one book that fills a niche and is really good.
Yeah. And someone who appreciates what all different genres can have happen with them in comics. And someone who listens to the whining fanboys going, $3 is too much to pay for a digital comic, and goes, really? You want to put your money where your mouth is? Because all of our books are 99 cents or $1.99.
Yeah.
So there, you have no, there's nothing stopping you.
Yeah.
If you really cared about how expensive it was, you would be buying our books.
Yeah.
And that's, like, I can afford to read 3 Monkey Brain books for one, I don't know, I can't think of a shitty Big Two book.
That's funny.
Suicide Squad.
Hawkman.
I forgot that Hawkman even existed.
I had for sure thought it was canceled.
I thought it was canceled too.
It seems very cancelable.
Yes. But yeah, I can read 3 Monkey Brain books for one issue of Hawkman.
And it's super sad that you said Suicide Squad, because
I read the first issue.
It was Suicide Squad, and now it's Suicide Squad.
But yeah, but it was never Suicide Squad from the relaunch. It was
No. But like from the original Suicide Squad.
The Ostrander Suicide Squad. I love
some of the best comics ever.
Yeah.
And then they made, we got Arkham Asylum.
Let's put Harley Quinn in hot pants and a corset and
call it a day now. Yep.
And don't get me wrong, if there's something about Suicide Squad that is floating a listener's boat, I would love for them to tell me what it was. But I read the first issue and went, no, it's not what I want to read. I don't want to read it. I would love for Suicide Squad to be a book that I want to read.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Well, I remember on your latest episode, you were talking about Checkmate for a very brief moment.
Yeah.
That was the latest Suicide Squad. That was so great.
It was so Checkmate, but the Checkmate was very clearly the sequel to Ostrander Suicide Squad.
Yeah,
because Greg Rucka knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, we should probably wrap it up. Is there anything else you need to sell people on?
When you said that there was a sell me on it thing, I'm going to sell, and you may have seen it, but if you haven't, and if people out listening haven't, Noises Off, the film.
Oh, okay. Tell the listeners.
It is a stage play, and it's about putting on a play, putting on a farce.
Yeah.
And it's the backstage hijinks that happen in this 3-act play about putting on a farce.
Kind of a Slings and Arrows type thing.
Yeah. It was in the 90s, early 90s. John Bogdanovich.
Peter Bogdanovich.
Peter Bogdanovich. I was thinking John Bogdanovich. Peter Bogdanovich directed a film version of it that was panned, like universally panned. I think someone called it the unfunniest film ever made. And I'm like, because when I watched it in high school, I was crying.
Yeah.
How hysterical it is. Because it's a great script that is not always perfectly paced.
Yeah.
And it is the film itself is a little over long, but once you get into the rhythm of it, once you get past the first act and everything's set up, you've got Michael Caine as the director.
Mm-hmm.
You've got red hair, really, really funny. Carol Burnett. Mm-hmm. You've got Christopher Reeve. You've got Mary Lou Henner. You've got Mark Lynn Baker. Wow. You've got Three's Company. John
Penner?
No. Why can't I remember his name? John Ritter.
Ritter. Right.
John Ritter. And it's just all this stuff happening.
Yeah.
And you never see more than the first act. Like, you never see the end of the play, except in a little bookend that they added onto the movie. But you see the first act three ways. Once during the dress rehearsal, the day before they go on, where they can't even make it through. Like, they're stopping all the time.
Yeah.
Then you see...
Which is a bad sign in a dress rehearsal. Yeah.
It's an awful sign in a dress rehearsal. And then you're kind of like, okay, so he's sleeping with her, but he's actually supposed to be with her. And the stage manager is, you know, Mark Lynn Baker, Cousin Larry. He's hilarious. And Christopher Reeve is so good. Like, to see all these dead people, like, making you laugh again is awesome. And then the second act is the exact same play from backstage. So you don't really ever see the front, but you see them all running around and miming because you can't really say anything, but like the soap opera that's continuing happens. The third act is, again, after they've been doing it for like 2 months on the road, everyone hates each other and it's falling apart. Nice. And you get to watch it fall apart as an audience member.
That's fascinating.
From the front. And like, three people are playing one character on stage at one point because they've tried to keep the play going instead of going, nope, stop, we have to start this over again.
Yeah.
It is so funny.
I gotta check that out. That sounds great.
Yeah.
I've got a quick one. I know I mentioned the dupe issue of Wolverine the X-Men, but this last Friday, Netflix released 12 episodes of the new TV show House of Cards.
Okay.
Based on the original English versions, starring Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright, not Robin Wright Penn anymore, as political operatives in current-day DC. It's pretty good. There is a conceit that he does aside to the audience, which could be a little bit weird. It reminded me of, actually, those commercials for DirecTV where they take a... like a scene from a movie, and then one of the actors starts talking to you, and it's kind of weird. It reminded me of that at first, but, you know, it's kind of just a funny way of getting you into this person's head. They do a lot of, you know, dramatic irony. They could pull a lot of that out by, you know, him telling you that something is going to happen or that he's actually lying, and you kind of get that as well. It gets you in the sort of inscrutable mind of a political operative in D.C.
Nice.
Then the main character is the House Majority Whip for a Democratic Congress, who, when the new Democratic president is elected, he expects he's going to be the Secretary of State, is soundly rebuffed, and he decides to destroy the Secretary of State from within.
Nice.
So it's pretty great. I'm probably going to watch the rest of it this week, but it's on Netflix. It's a Netflix original series, and it's kind of completely changing the way we're going to watch TV from now on. Because if this works out, you know, the episode-by-episode model of getting these things is kind of... you know, it's going away. This is something I noticed with Downton Abbey or Doctor Who. Should we be... is there an etiquette to waiting on between the English version, the English release, and then when it comes out in the States? Because, like...
well,
how do we navigate this brave new world? And now, House of Cards and Arrested Development in a couple months, it's going to drop all at once.
Right. Well, there is an etiquette if you pay attention to the law.
Yeah.
In the sense that, yeah, you should not, because you should not be able to get...
but if I was...
but you can.
If I was, per se, wandering around and saw a site where it was just streaming, like, oh, I just pressed a button, that doesn't seem so wrong.
No. We could talk a lot about digital rights and how copyright worked when digital didn't exist.
Yeah.
And now it's this whole thing.
Now it's completely changed the game. So, for instance, Netflix... maybe people should be releasing everything on Netflix that way. Like, if Downton came out on Netflix, people are paying for that service.
Mm-hmm.
And you would completely counteract the piracy.
You would, but smaller series, and I'm thinking television less so, but like smaller independent films who go on Netflix, they don't get the same kind of revenue that they would get for a streaming purchase on iTunes or even like a limited run in a theater.
Yeah.
Like Punching the Clown, which isn't available in Canadian Netflix, but is available in American Netflix. I watched it and I liked it, but I'm like, how much money did they get that I watched this? Probably almost nothing.
Yeah, it's
a licensing.
It's going to be
fee,
right? Minuscule, really. But the audience that you can attract that way, like, it is strange to think about releasing things in this age because piracy. I read and I firmly believe piracy is a regional issue. It is not an issue of, you know, there is morality involved, but it's not like it's regional because if everything came out at the same time, mm-hmm. which it should, then your choices are different. Right?
Well, they're different, but then it's still, can I get this for free or not?
Or if it was just going to be on TV anyway, you're already paying for your cable. You're just going to watch.
Sometimes you're not though. I'm not paying for HBO.
It's true.
So if I was going to download an HBO series, that would be stealing with giant
big deal
air
piracy.
Quotes.
Yeah, yeah. Now there was that oatmeal thing that, you know, caused a whole big shitstorm about Game of Thrones. With that respect, but like the distribution model afforded by Netflix,
mm-hmm.
I feel like if the other companies sort of, you know, took a hold of this and were able to grasp it somehow, they would be able to kind of cut out piracy a little bit differently mm-hmm. because it is a secure revenue stream that people will engage with.
Yeah.
So, like, I feel that this series, House of Cards, and probably to a greater extent Arrested Development, are most likely going to change the way we watch TV a little bit.
Yeah.
It gives people who can't wait,
mm-hmm.
it gives them an out because now you can do it and pay for it.
Yeah, and DVD culture has trained people to yeah. watch television shows in seasons as opposed to in episodes. So yeah. let's do something that is brand new. Chunks go.
Yeah, and I know I'll probably get called out on this by James Leask, of course, because he's a staunch believer in sort of, you know, you watch it the time when it comes on, etc. But I feel like this is kind of a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not even seeing the repercussions at all now. There's things coming down the pipe we have no idea that this is probably going to do.
Right. And watching it when it comes on works if you get in on something in the ground floor, whereas if something gets good and you didn't think it was going to be good, so you didn't watch it, then the way television works right now, if you get into the middle of a series, nothing makes sense anymore.
Yeah.
Especially the really good ones.
Well, this is something that came out when we started watching The Wire, because The Wire, I would buy the box sets. And I bought the first three. The fourth one came out, and I was like, okay, I'm going to download it. I need to see what happens. It's The Wire. I'm going to pay for it anyway. I'll buy it after it's done. I feel like they can let me find out. But the way that show is structured, it doesn't work individually. And you can't watch it, you know, and wait a week. So, you know, it's designed for me to buy the box set, which I did.
Yeah.
And again, having the entirety of it available
yeah.
at your fingertips, legally.
Yeah.
This is a big deal.
Yeah. I have a whole, and I won't do it, but if you ever have me on again, which I would love to, because this is super fun.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you.
But I have this whole theory of how comics trade paperbacks and DVD box sets are very similar.
Oh, no. I know that theory. Yeah.
I wrote this giant essay that I then deleted because I'm like, well, what's the point? Who's going to read this that someone already hasn't come up with a better idea, but yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, I put that theory into practice.
There you go.
Because, yeah, a Vertigo, again, designed to be done that way.
Yeah.
Especially, yeah, the big Vertigo series, you think. Yeah. You can make a little bit of money, or you can make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it makes me sad that Vertigo is in its current state. I hope they get their shit together. I really want to see what Karen Berger does next, because, you know, if she makes a move, it's going to be big.
Yeah. Well, even, you know what? I would love for her just to be like, I'm done with comics publishing. Put me, you know what? You saw what I did. For 20 years, I ran this yeah. place. And when I had basically full creative control, it was the biggest thing that company had ever done.
Yeah.
Well, since the modern age of comics. So what would you like me to do for you, Random House?
Yeah. Book publishing.
It's not the same, but it...
I would rather that she was in charge of FX.
Yeah.
Something like that. Because, yeah, book publishing is a whole different...
it is. But I mean, like, to apply it to something else.
Yeah. Like, the skills she's picked up and mastered in her position at Vertigo, if she brings that talent to another arena, it's going to be huge, whatever it is.
Nobody says anything bad about Karen Berger.
No.
Nobody says anything bad about her. Yeah. And there are very few people in that kind of a position in the comic book industry that no one has anything bad to say about.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody, maybe one or two people, but hardly.
Stanzakai. No one's coming out against Stanzakai.
Yeah, Sergio Aragonés. He is a douchebag.
Yeah.
No, nobody's saying that.
But she's in that level.
Yeah, yeah.
She's a Hernandez brother or a, a Sakai. Just that rarefied sphere of just...
Yeah.
They're the ones we love. Everyone loves them.
And if you know, as a creator, if they ask you to do something with them, you would say yes because you want to.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
Anyway...
So, yeah, where can people find you on this beautiful internet that this is going out on?
I'm on Twitter at Dr. Teeth with a underscore in between Dr. and Teeth. I have a very infrequently updated WordPress site for Scotch and Comics, scotchandcomics.wordpress.com. Those are the two big ones. I'm on all kinds of weird...
And there's Scotch and Comics things. Available on iTunes.
Finally, I figured out how to do that. That was nice. Good. Should we talk about the...
We should.
The thing?
Yeah. There is another reason why Devin is on today. Him and I and Aaron, who is in the other room right now, we are all working together on a great project that you should all come out to see in 2 weeks. Yeah. It's pretty close.
February 19th.
Yeah. We are working together with Graphic Content and Comic Book Film Series. I've talked about this many times in the past. We are putting on a screening of Point Blank, the classic 60s new wave influenced crime film starring Lee Marvin in one of his most badass roles, I would say. Equal with The Dirty Dozen.
Oh, yeah.
Just, yeah. Great, great crime film. And if you want to know the comics connection to it, come down and I'll tell you.
I'll tell you.
Devin will tell you. Yeah. Come on down. So, Metro Cinema, you know where it is. I talk about it all the time. It's going to be awesome. And it's going to have a Scotch pairing as well. We got the Scotch and Comics guy. So, we got this shit on lock. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You can find me at Matt_BOWES. Or at my website, thisnerdinglife.com, where you may or may not have found this podcast. And we're on iTunes, but you know that already. Anyway, thanks so much for coming on, Devin.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we'll talk next week. Thanks so much.
I'm Commander Shepard, and The Spoiler Show is my favorite podcast on the Citadel.